The writer Colin McCann isn't afraid to take on big subjects, and his ambition has delivered a shelf full of awards from both sides of the Atlantic. He grew up in Dublin, but moved to the United States in the mid-1980s, and now lives in New York. The city is the setting for his international bestseller, one of my favourite books of all time, Let the Great World Spin, in which Philip Pettit's tightrope walk between the Twin Towers in 1974 plays a key role. He's also written a novel about both sides of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinian people from the perspectives of two fathers. He collaborated with Diane Foley, whose son James was executed by Islamic State militants, to create a memoir, American Mother, which was published last year. Most recently, his novel Twist focuses on the vulnerability of the undersea cables carrying the world's internet data. You've brought a wealth of musical data today, Colin, including Gretzky, Prokofiev, Brahms, but I think you want to start with Haydn?
Yes, I think so, primarily because it's Richter playing it. I wrote a book called Dancer back in the early 2000s. It's a fictionalization of the life of Rudolf Nureyev. And when I started exploring Nureyev, I found Richter everywhere. He kept popping up in photographs and in sounds. And when I began to listen to him, there was a huge muscularity there, but also a beautiful finesse that seemed to align itself with the spirit of Rudolf Nureyev and the way that Nureyev danced. And so I would listen to Richter while I was writing the book. I love listening to music. In fact, I often align my books with a particular piece. And so listening to Richter over and over again, I think infused some of that same muscularity and hopefully some of the finesse into the actual prose. I also had a photograph of his hands, and apparently he was able to stretch to a 13th, which is sort of
that's
phenomenal.
That's enormous, yes. Veritably Rachmaninoff-like.
Exactly.
Well, here is Haydn, then, the finale of the Piano Sonata in E-flat major, performed by Sviatoslav Richter.
Thank you.
His playing really suits the actual music, those sort of repeated, almost wrong notes, but right notes.
Yeah, and you can just feel Richter just infusing all of that Russian melancholy and passion and poetry and muscularity, but with that beautiful sensitivity that's going on too. And always great, by the way, to begin a program with a finale.
Start at the end.
Yes. There you go, the beginning of the end.
The finale of Haydn's Piano Sonata in E-flat Major, performed by Sviatoslav Richter. Tell me a little bit about your childhood, Colin. You grew up in Dublin?
I grew up in Dublin, and my father had several passions. He began as a football player. He played for Charlton Athletic in London. Then he gave that up and became a reporter and went to the Fens. Then moved back to Dublin, where he wrote books about roses and about Irish cultural figures. And he was also a newspaper man. And he had several passions, one of them being music as well, which I think is going to lead us into our next piece. Because on Sunday mornings, this is what he used to do. He would go down his garden, talk to his roses, and he'd have a football at his feet. And then he'd come back in and he'd go to the record player and he would drop it down. And I, as a very young boy, would hear this sort of music seeping out from the speakers with all that crackle coming off the record too.
And do you love the lyrics here?
I love the lyrics here because they remind me of him, but there's also something deeply sort of American about them. And my father always had a graw, which is a love for America as the sort of westward ho, the place to go. And bringing in Hoagie Carmichael seemed to suggest some of that. And it felt to me like the Mississippi, and that the Mississippi was somehow sounding in the living room.
Well, this is Lazy River. Lazy river where the oatmeal run meets lazy, lazy river in the noonday sun. Linger in the shade of a kind old tree. Throw away your troubles, dream a dream with me. Up the lazy river where the robin's song awakes a bright new morning, we can loaf along. Blue skies up above, everyone's in love. Up the lazy river, how happy you can be. Up the lazy river with me. Those chords had a sort of wonderful dirty quality to them, didn't they? They add spice to it.
Yeah, it's like a bit of ragtime that's going on in there. I feel a little bit of E.L. Doctorow, who's one of my favourite writers, by the way, sipping in there. And, you know, my father used to play that along with records by Dylan Thomas. And I just had a variety of things that he was interested in. But that one was one of, as you say, the spicier ones that really hit me as a child.
Lazy River by Sidney R. Rodin, who used to make a living playing on the riverboats going up the Lazy River, and Hoagie Carmichael. What about your mother? Because she hailed from Derry.
Yeah, she's from the north. And in fact, they met in London. They met at a dance hall here in Victoria and sort of went from there. And they would talk about those dance hall days. But they got married in Egypt, of all places, because my father left, did what every Irishman should never do, was join the RAF. And they sent him out as an intelligence officer. So they got married in Port Said, of all places, in the early 1950s.
And do you think that your father's journalism rubbed off on you a bit?
Oh, absolutely. My father was a journalist. Also, he invited other journalists into our home. And also, my dad was a man who didn't drink, but he understood that there were a lot of writers around Dublin who would come to him, and he was a features editor, and he would commission them to write. And so often, at about 7 o'clock in the evening, because there were no ATMs at this stage back in the early 1970s, we would hear a knock, knock, knock on the door, and there would be people saying, "Sean, will you lend us 20 quid? And it would be Benedict Kylie and people like that. I could almost hear the taxi sloshing away with joy down to the local pub. You know, we had books everywhere. We had writers everywhere. So I grew up in a literary household.
You were named Young Journalist of the Year in 1983, but 3 years later, you left for the US, didn't you?
I did. I took off and I tried to write a novel when I got there. I failed miserably. And so I ended up going on the road, the sort of Kerouac journey, but this time on a bicycle. So I started out in Boston, ended up a year and a half later crossing the Golden Gate Bridge, a completely transformed human being, because I got to listen to the stories of people, but I also got to listen to, I suppose, the sounds of America.
You travelled some 8,000 miles on that bike, I think.
It was amazing, really, because I went all the way down south, then across to New Orleans, into Texas, down through Mexico, up. And people would ask me, why are you doing that? You know, you're giving up a good job in Dublin, and because I was in the newspapers. But I always think that young people should do a year, if not more, of something that doesn't compute in the vast scheme of things. So there were times when I'd be out on the road in Texas or Wyoming, literally, they'd be so lonely out there. Sometimes lie down in the middle of the road because there'd be no cars coming for an hour and a half or more. But certainly at night when I slept out by the campgrounds or by the rivers or in the mountainsides, that I would hear the music of coyotes and nighttime America.
Were you ever frightened doing that?
Yes. I was always frightened. I'm still frightened by it. I have a new house out in Connecticut where there are coyotes, and you hear them late at night, and there's no way that any human being can not be frightened by the sound, especially when you're zipped up in a tent. I actually prefer when I'm out sleeping, you know, and I can get away relatively quickly, or jump up out of a sleeping bag and light a fire. One thing that you had to do was you had to hang your food up high in a tree, because especially if there were bears around, they would come around and they would go through your things.
I suppose they might have mistaken you for roadkill, Colin.
Yeah, I felt like roadkill. Look, I'm just turned 60. I definitely feel like roadkill now, but the fact of the matter is, and we all know this, the animals are much more scared of us than we are of them.
And you met extraordinary people.
Yeah, at every turn. The poorest people in Mississippi, the wealthiest people in Aspen, Colorado, people who invited me into their homes to sleep and, you know, maybe you want to paint the front of our house for a week and you can hang around for a week and make some money. I dug some ditches in Idaho to help out the firefighters. I stopped in every Dublin I could find, and there are actually 13 Dublins in the United States, and I tried to write an article for the newspapers back home. I got in trouble sometimes, got knocked off the bike at one stage. The Amish people helped me out in Pennsylvania. But most of the time, it was pure, friendliness. And I sometimes wonder if I went back on that bike, so that was 1986, If I went back on that bike now, would it be the same America that I would find? And I still think maybe it's time to do that journey again. Maybe I'd do it with my son this time and see how it works out.
Tell me about the next music, and in particular, The Flautist.
The next music is the music of the American West. And I think it is some of the most extraordinary music that you can get. Again, my father introduced me to Carlos Nocay, and I remember listening to it and thinking, oh, this is the soundtrack to my journey. I don't know, it connects me deeply with an ancient America that might be gone but sort of lingers. It also makes me quite sad to feel what it is that we have lost in our relentless pursuit of changing the environment and changing cultural norms. Music is extraordinarily powerful in signaling to me that a lot of things can be taken away from you, but not the story.
This is Song for the Morning Star. I kept thinking of you out on the road looking up at the morning star as I listened to that. It is a very evocative piece.
It's a beautifully evocative piece. And I would look at the morning stars. And while I was on the road, I did learn my stars, obviously the North Star, obviously the morning star. But I also learned how to guide myself almost like a sailor at night by the stars. They're different now, the stars. You see so many satellites moving through the sky. And I suppose that particular beautiful flute music is really evocative of an ancient time, but also mourns itself as it is being created. And that's one of the reasons why I absolutely adore it. It brings me back, and I can feel myself out on the road as a much younger man.
Raymond Carlos Nakai playing Song for the Morning Star. In 1988, Colin McCann, you actually moved to Texas.
I did. I went to a home for juvenile delinquents to be a wilderness counselor. My really bad joke about all of this is that I probably made them more delinquent than they already were. But it was an extraordinary time to deal with young men who had come out of broken families and prisons and to live for 3 months at a time in the wilderness. I learned so much, not even about them, but about myself.
You finished your degree at the University of Texas in Austin. Is that where you first met your soon-to-be wife, Alison?
Well, yeah, I was in Austin. I'd written a book. I went up to New York to try to meet an agent. Instead of meeting an agent, I met her. So I think I got a good deal out of all of that because we're still together all those years later.
In 1993, you both set off to live in Japan. That must have been quite a change.
It was a big change. And to be honest with you, I mean, she wanted to learn Japanese. She is a linguist. And I didn't want to go. But it was a perfect time as a young man to be lonely. Because I was lonely out there. We were in a town called Kitakyushu. We weren't in any of the big places and nobody really spoke English. And she was learning Japanese. I learned about five phrases of Japanese, but I wrote and wrote and wrote while I was there. And that's really where I got my apprenticeship, I suppose, in silence and in loneliness and in learning the discipline to tell a story.
You were actually writing your first short story collection, weren't you?
Yeah.
Fishing the Slow Black River, which won the Rooney Prize. So you were beginning to be on your way.
I was beginning to be on my way. Can I just say, though, that in the years prior, I had gotten several rejection slips. And one of the things that I would always say to young writers and young musicians and anybody who are going into the arts, they should tack Samuel Beckett's beautiful maxim above their desk. No matter, try again, fail better. And I like that notion of failing better. Now, many years later, I still think that we got to keep trying to fail better.
Because in a way, we've never reached the end, have we? It's always the beginning.
Beautifully said. You know what John Berger said? He said, if I'd have known as a child what the life of an adult would have been, I never would have believed it. I never could have believed it would be so unfinished. And I love that. The idea that life is constantly unfinished. Now, when I was in my 20s, I was sure that I'd be finished by the time I was 40. And when I was 40, I was sure, 100% sure, that I'd be finished by the time I was 60. But now that I'm 60, I'm sure that I will be constantly unfinished. I think I've learned enough now.
You moved back to New York, started writing a book about the subway. What was it about that that caught your imagination in particular?
Well, I was amazed that there were homeless people living in the subway tunnels of New York. And so I went down, I got to meet them, I got to know them. When I was doing it in the 1990s, there were about 5,000 people living underground in New York. Most of them, to be honest, at the mouth of the tunnels, where there still was some light. But some people living deep, deep, deep in the tunnels, like they were trying to hide some sort of secret from the world. And often they were. And often I would sit with them and they would tell me their stories. And they were heartbreaking things. But at the same time, I was amazed by the tunnels themselves and that they had been built at all. I wrote a book called This Side of Brightness, which is about the homeless people living in the subway tunnels. But it's also about the way the tunnels were built back in the early part of the 20th century.
How were they built then?
Dynamite and shovel. Take your pick and your shovel and your old dynamite, as the song goes, and we'll shift a few tons of this earthly delight. That's an old Irish song. And yeah, muscle, ingenuity as well at the same time.
The people that built those tunnels, they were known as sandhogs, weren't they?
Yeah, sandhogs. It's a great term. And they were, up until 9/11, they were the highest incidence of death of any job in the United States. They would lose a man a mile creating those tunnels.
Well, it's not a tunnel, but it's a road, Raglan Road next, by Morrison and the Chieftains.
Yeah, Raglan Road used to bring me home. And I feel that as an emigrant, I was living in two countries. And I still feel that way. So when I was in New York, I'd be going home to Dublin. And when I was in Dublin, I'd be going home to New York. And then one of my favourite poems was Raglan Road by Patrick Kavanagh. And this is a beautiful version of it.
On I saw the danger, yet I walked along the enchanted way. And I said, let grief be a falling leaf at the dawning of the day. This is on Grafton Street in November. We trip lightly along the ledge of a deep ravine where can be seen the worth of passions pledged. The Queen of Hearts still making tarts, and I not making hay. But I loved too much by such and such is happiness thrown away.
All right.
So hurriedly, my reason must allow that I would not, as I should, a creature made of clay. When the angel woos, are the clay, he lose his wings at the dawn of the day.
All right.
Raglan Road, Van Morrison and the Chieftains. Colin McCann, you've written about the troubled history of Ireland, much of it seen from a family and child's point of view. Was that an important aspect of writing about Ireland for you?
a super important aspect. My mum is from Derry and she used to bring me up as a child on the bus from Dublin, past the border, past the checkpoint, into Derry and into places that I didn't understand. So why have we gone from green postboxes to red postboxes? You know, those simple questions that become huge questions in the end. You know, why are we being taken off the bus and why are you telling me to shush? What is wrong with my accent up here? And then when I get to her family farm, sort of being let free to run the fields and everything like that, quite idyllic in certain ways, but also hemmed in by politics. And I wrote about that in a short collection that I'm actually very proud of called Everything in This Country Must.
You've travelled to many countries in order to research or write your books. I was thinking particularly about Russia in 2001 and the dancer, the Nureyev, fictionalized account of his life. Where in Russia did you go?
I went to Ufa, which was the birthplace of Rudolf Nureyev, and I walked the streets. I went to St. Petersburg. I went to Moscow. But look, what I would do often was I would just hang out and I would go to, say, a Stalin-era apartment and I would learn more by sitting in a stairwell surrounded by broken bottles and people coming up and down with their washing because the lift was broken and just listening than I would in, say, a formal interview or even a history book. And I think that's one of the things that fiction can do. Fiction can capture the pulse of the moment without having to be handcuffed by fact.
So it's all appropriate that it should be Prokofiev next.
Absolutely.
And what have you chosen and why?
Well, this is Martha Argerich. She is one of the world's great pianists, of course. And I've chosen the first movement of the Piano Concerto No. 3. And when I heard her first, I was sort of, you know, the moment when you're there and you're listening, it's like, and the oxygen is gone from the air. And you just think, oh, well, who is this? And why is this? And I just think she's extraordinary.
The first movement of the Prokofiev Piano Concerto No. 3 in C major, performed by Martha Argerich and the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Claudio Abbado. There's something about her playing, I don't know if you agree, Colin McCann, which reminds me a bit about the Richter. You know, you were saying Yes. There was finesse and muscle.
Yes.
Well, she has that too.
She does too, yeah. Mm. That firmness of sound, which is really beautiful. In other words, I feel that she knows exactly where she wants to go. There's a confidence there, but an openness to the music too, which I find absolutely alluring.
One of my favourite books, as I think I mentioned, is Let the Great World Spin, which won the National Book Award for Fiction in 2009. How did you come to conceive a book with tightrope walking at the top of the Twin Towers as your subject, as your metaphor, if you like?
On the very day of 9/11, I was walking around New York and I was thinking, how am I going to deal with all of this? And then part of me remembered that Paul Auster had written an essay about Philippe Petit, the tightrope walker who'd gone across the World Trade Center towers 9 times in 1974. And I thought, what an amazing act of creation that was, that worked in sort of perfect opposition to the act of destruction 27 years later. And I knew it that day that I would eventually use that as a metaphor. It wasn't until 5 years later that I started writing it, and almost a decade later that I published the book Let the Great World Spin.
Did you know how you were going to use that image?
I never know. The great lie about writers, and maybe it's the same about musicians, is that we know what we're doing. We never know what we're doing. We're operating on a wing and a prayer, and we hope that once we get into the studio of the computer or the studio of the typewriter, that somehow the saxophones will work for us and the piano will work for us and the go cello go, you know, at the right particular time. You hope. And I think a lot of it is, for me anyway, is about stamina. Are you going to be able to fail at this and get up again the next day and continue it again? So for Let the Great World Spin, I had to learn a lot of things. But I love doing that because it feels like I go to university every time I write a book.
What do you feel you learned?
I learned so much about grief and the losing of children, the losing of friends, lovers, a country, the losing of ideas. So much of writing for me is about confronting the idea of loss and how are we going to recover from all of that.
That's a rather nice introduction to our next music, isn't it?
Well, the next music, I mean, is, you know, the Symphony of Sorrowful Songs. And it's one of the most beautiful pieces that I've come across. And I only really discovered it recently. And I only really discovered Gretzky recently. And I listened to it and I was like, how did I miss this for so many years? It feels that he is playing what I've been trying to write about mothers who have lost children, the notion of loss. And again, I sat back and was stunned by the whole way that he approaches the music.
The second movement of the Symphony of Sorrowful Songs by Henryk Gorecki. We heard Joanna Kozlowska with the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Kazimierz Kord. When you hear that music, is it possible for you to say what it is that's moving you?
I'm just sitting here listening to this and I'm simply torn apart by the beauty of it. And I think it's really important to talk about that. You know, one of the functions of literature is to, and any art, is to get to the beauty and acknowledge the difficulty too. One of my favourite lines in all of poetry comes from the Mu'allaqat, which are a series of 6th century pre-Islamic poems that were hung in the marketplaces in Damascus and Syria and Baghdad. And it says quite simply, or not simply, is there any hope that this desolation can bring us solace? And in the immediate moment of desolation, I don't think anybody can achieve any solace. But in the aftermath of the desolation, somehow through music like that and through literature that confronts that human desolation, I think we get to something that keeps us going. You know, I'm almost in tears listening to that because it's so beautiful and powerful and it speaks to so many people. You know, a symphony of sorrowful songs about, you know, all the mothers who have lost their children at times when they shouldn't have done so. And in this particular political moment, it speaks volumes too.
Last year, Colin McCann saw the publication of American Mother, which you co-wrote with Diane Foley, the mother of James Foley, the journalist executed by Islamic State militants in 2014. How did you two actually come together?
I had seen a photograph of her son, Jim Foley, reading a copy of Let the Great World Spin, of all things, in a bunker in Afghanistan. I had written to her to say, if ever you want somebody to write about your experience or your son's experience, I would like to have that. And she didn't get the letter. So for 7 years, I didn't hear from her until I had written a book called A Paragon. And I was on a Zoom and she happened to be on the same Zoom and we got together. And then she told me, by the way, I'm going to see my son's killer in a month or two. Would you like to accompany me? And I said, absolutely, I would love to accompany you. In many ways, we were sort of helixed together. She gave me the story or access to the story. And then I was able to put her particular music on it. It was an incredible journey.
What did she say to Alexander Coty when she first met him, the man who murdered her son?
She didn't know what she was going to call him. Would she call him Alexander? Would she call him Alex? And she walked across that room. She stood at the desk in front of him and she made an immediate decision. There he was in his green prison uniform, shackles on his ankles. She said, I'm going to call him exactly what his mother, his own mother, called him. And she said, hi, Alexander, I'm Diane Foley. And then she said, it's nice to meet you. And can you imagine that room and the silence in that room? And then she talked with him for the next 2 days. And then 6 months later, she talked to him for a full day. And it's all about compassion and forgiveness and also anger and violence.
How does this next piece by Sting relate, connect to the book?
Oh, this fits in so well. Sting wrote this next song, The Empty Chair, for Jim Foley. And in it, he talks about Jim being away from the dinner table. But there's always an empty chair there and how the empty chair will get filled at some stage by the spirit of Jim Foley. And I have seen Sting, who's now a friend of mine, sing this song to Diane in front of like 400 people in the Philadelphia Free Library. There was not a dry eye in the house, even his and even hers and certainly mine and anybody who was listening to it, because I think it's a profoundly beautiful, poetic piece of music.
If I should close my eyes, that my soul can see, and there's a place at the table that you set for me. So many thousand miles over land and sea, I hope to that you hear my prayer, and somehow I'll be there. It's but a concrete floor where my head will lay, and though the walls of this prison are as cold as clay, but there's a shaft of light where I count my days. So don't despair of the empty chair, and somehow I'll be there. Some days I'm strong, some days I'm weak. Days I'm so broken I can barely speak. There's a place in my head where my thoughts still roam. Somehow I've come home. And when the winter comes and the trees lie bare, and you just stare out the window in the darkness there, well, I was always late for every meal you swear. But keep my place and the empty chair, and somehow I'll be there, and somehow I'll be there.
Sting and the empty chair. You started writing with Sting a bit.
Yeah, I'm doing a musical with him for Let the Great World Spin. You know what's interesting about him is he's still a milkman's son. You know, he's famous all over the world. No matter where you go and you turn on the radio, you're going to hear him, and he's recognised on the street and everything. But he's still very much a man of the people, and I mean that in the very, very best sense. He cares about people. He knows what's going on. He does have that empathetic reach into, you know, the working people, the working place where he came from. But he also knows the rest of the world now, too. He's a fascinating man.
Now, another extension to your writing of this story is about to come into being, because there's to be an opera of American Mother with music by Charlotte Bray, due to premiere in Germany in May of this year, 2025. How have you been involved with that? Did you write the libretto?
I wrote the libretto. But the real work, the true coalface work, is Charlotte composing the music. And it's beautiful to watch. But it's a brand new territory for me. To be honest with you, can I be totally honest? I really knew nothing about opera beforehand. And I just jumped in head first. And Charlotte, she stood back and she let me write it. And I'm very proud of it now.
Do you have a particular time of day, Colin, where you like to write?
Yeah, early morning.
The earlier, morning star.
Morning star, you betcha. The earlier the better. If I can wake up in what I call dream time, like 4 o'clock in the morning before anyone stirs and before the internet comes on, even before coffee or anything else, and get into my office and do an hour or two of work, it's when I do my best stuff.
Your next music was partially as the result of a trip to Gaza, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, my great friend, Colin Muckanumra, who is possibly one of the greatest fiddle players in the world, came with me to Gaza. Now, he'd written this music beforehand. And in fact, this particular music was the soundtrack for me personally for my novel, A Paragon. I listened to his album, And Now the Weather, which in Irish is Agus Anois an Aimsir. I listened to it over and over and over again in order to infuse some of the really beautiful spirit of his music. Now, he used to be the fiddle player for The Frames, the rock band The Frames. Glenn Hansard is the lead singer. Now he's got a solo career on his own. I think he's one of the world's most innovative musicians. And He came with me to the West Bank and to Israel, and he played this song in a little cafe called the Cafe Singer in Beit Zohur, and all the children came running. It was one of the most extraordinary moments of my life.
Thank you. And that's Colm McInerney being extraordinarily playful with his song, The Finish Line. As I said, he's one of my great, great friends. And what that reminds me of, to be honest, is a time that we went to Bethlehem together, and we were in the Aida refugee camp, which is unfortunately one of the most tear gas places on earth. But we were at a place called the Al-Awad Cultural Centre with a man by the name of Abdul Fattah. And as Abdul Fattah was talking about repair, human repair, by dancing and storytelling and bringing all these kids together, Colm went over to a shelf where there was a broken fiddle, and he began to repair the fiddle as Abdul Fattah was speaking. It was absolutely amazing. We found out later that the fiddle came from Bristol. All these things are connected, you know, in extraordinary ways. The whole world is connected. But Abdul Fattah, when he finished speaking, Colm began to play a song called Roisin Dubh, which is an ancient Irish love song. And, you know, again, it was one of those moments when the world seemed to come together and be brought together by music. And he is, for me, penny for penny, one of the most gorgeous musicians that we have anywhere on this fine planet of ours.
Your latest book, Colm McCann, is Twist. It's about the fibre optic cables that exist on the ocean floor and the people who fix them when they break. But it's about so much more than that as well. You do so much research for your projects, and I wonder how you researched this one.
This one, I went out in a boat, but only for a short amount of time. But I travelled to South Africa. I travelled to several other places. I was absolutely blown away by the notion that 95% of the world's intercontinental information travels in tiny tubes about the size of your garden hose at the very bottom of our oceans. And the bottom of our oceans, as we know, are full of mountains and canyons and crags and valleys and cliffs. And so these cables, they snake through all sorts of landscapes. Sometimes they get broken by an underwater landslide or an underwater earthquake, sometimes by sabotage, and sometimes by fishing trawlers that are trawling at the bottom of the sea. I was interested in this notion that we just talked about, actually, of human repair, but I was also fascinated by the fact that virtually everything that we are now, you know, all our emails, all our tweets, all our financial transactions, $10 trillion a day, is going through these cables. And so what happens when they get disrupted and they get broken? That's part of the story.
But it's also a metaphor for what we're doing to the planet, isn't it?
It's a perfect metaphor for what we're doing to the planet. Mm-hmm. And in this particular story, the rain comes down so hard on the Congo River that the Congo River floods and flushes out to sea. It's almost like the opposite to Conrad's Heart of Darkness in certain ways, because in Conrad's Heart of Darkness, they go up the Congo River. In this one, the Congo River gets a little bit of its revenge, tears the cables apart, and we go down to the abyssal zone. And I love that word because that's where the word abyss comes from, obviously. But we don't know all that much about the darkness down there. But that's where all our thoughts and dreams and craziness and silliness is traveling right now.
And the character who's in charge of fixing the cable, Conway, is a free diver, a man who has provoked a great deal of loyalty amongst his crew, but in a sense is going to the heart of darkness himself.
Yeah, he does go to the heart of darkness. And I'm interested in Niels Bohr's notion of truth, and that at the far end of one truth, there is another truth that is sometimes the opposite and yet is equally true. So that technology is good, for instance, and technology is also eating us apart. Now, I don't know what sort of music I would actually play for their journey, but definitely the next piece of music brings out the sea for me. And I think it's really important because it's by the BBC Orchestra to acknowledge and those musicians, especially those musicians who I think come from islands, that we somehow are able to get at the sea, maybe better than other musicians, or the wind, as Seamus Heaney would say, those given notes that come in off the sea.
Thank you.
High Wind from Grace Williams' Sea Sketches for String Orchestra, performed by the strings of the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by John Andrews. And it did have a feeling of wind and sea movement, didn't it?
Oh, it's all there, right? You can hear the crash and you can hear the roar. And then you can hear the silences there too. She's pretty amazing. And also, the Philharmonic.
Colin McCann, you're the co-founder of a charity, Narrative 4, which tries to link young people through storytelling. How does that work?
Oh, it's the most amazing thing. It's one of the things I'm most proud of in my life alongside my books. Narrative 4 brings young people together to step into one another's shoes, to tell one another's stories across the classroom, across the city, across the country, and maybe then across the continent, because in so many ways we are held together with stories. And look, they've had an epidemic of loneliness and isolation unlike any that we have seen, particularly the young generation. And when they tell stories, personal stories, not didactic stories, to one another, they sort of look at one another in brand new ways. It's quite astonishing to see.
And empathy is key to this, really, isn't it?
It is. Radical empathy, actually.
Well, we've come to your final track, Colin. What are you going to choose?
I don't know. I don't want to finish. it just feels to me that we could go on and on. I've been really privileged to be on the show. Thank you so much for inviting me. And we're going to finish with the fourth movement of Brahms' Sonata Number 2 in F major.
What is it about this particular track you love?
Well, I think what I love about this is the power of the cello coming through. And we've had a lot of piano as well today. Just them being married together in this sort of extraordinary way. And it also brings me home in certain ways too.
Well, many thanks, Colin McCann.
Many thanks to you.